The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Dharma, the teachings, Buddhist teachings, Buddhist path broadly, is often characterized as providing more choice, freedom of choice, the opportunity to express our wholesome intentions. It's often talked about as opening a space in which we find ways of living that works. And it is true that suffering often feels like a kind of forgetting, that we forget something deep. And mindfulness is a way of remembering. Remembering what? Remembering the Dharma. And so in one sense, I think it's fair to say that this practice helps us remember, come back, exercise wise intention. But there's another sense in which we're really, happiness is a collection of good habits. And that we're not so much relying on choice and remembering, but that in fact we're relying on the momentum of our minds, the direction of the trajectory of our heart. Because in all these momentary states of mindfulness or kindness, generosity, joy, what's being forged in those momentary states of wholesomeness is actually a higher trait level of mindfulness or kindness. And by higher trait level, what's being pointed to is, we could say, is how mindful we are when we're not trying to be mindful. Which, in some ways, is more important than how mindful we are when we're trying to be mindful, right? And so, from this perspective, so much of what we're doing is actually creating wholesome habits, creating a kind of momentum of the mind. And increasingly, the default position of the mind is the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes, the four qualities of mind of friendliness and compassion, equanimity and sympathetic joy. And over time, it's not always a huge difference, but we can discern that the kind of place to which the mind defaults is less about worry and clinging and more in the direction of these wholesome mind states. So this is the sense in which we're practicing a kind of gradual path. There are these very pointed moments of insight, moments of radical freedom, but we're also just slowly accruing momentum, wholesome karma. So I wanted to talk tonight about joy, and we could say this kind of joy, this mudita, sympathetic joy, is a it's sort of when our heart, in a state of non-clinging, sees success or well-being in another. That is when the success and well-being of another in no way feels like a territorial encroachment on you. There's no protection. The heart feels open and naturally can delight in the well-being of another. So this is a story that Jack Kornfield's made well known. And it's from Maurice Sendak, who wrote Where the Wild Things Are, right? And this is kind of like the best mudita story, the best sympathetic joy story I know of. So Sendak tells the story of a boy who wrote to him, and this is Sendak. He sent me a charming card with a drawing. I loved it. I answer all my children's letters, sometimes very hastily, but this one I lingered over. I sent him a postcard and I drew a picture of a wild thing on it. I wrote, "Dear Jim, I loved your card." Then I got a letter back from his mother and she said, "Jim loved your card so much, he ate it." That to me was one of the highest compliments I'd ever received. He didn't care that it was an original drawing or anything. He saw it. He loved it. He ate it. This mudita, its spontaneous nature can be very, very bubbly, almost like a piti, rapturous type experience. So piti, rapture, is usually associated more with samadhi, with the gathered mind, what Max is talking about in the Thursday series. But mudita, sympathetic joy, can also have this kind of very effervescent, bubbly, rapturous kind of feeling. And we see, you know, in my own experience, this is the, you know, from a kind of selfish perspective, this is the main reason to teach meditation, actually, is that in seeing people practice, in seeing people grow, in seeing people fall in love with the Dharma, fall in love with a path, the primary reward is really the sense of mudita that I have. But as I was alluding to, any kind of sense of scarcity in oneself or territoriality, I'll talk more about this, threatens that, dampens that potential delight in sharing with another. This is Sam Harris, the author, wrote a book just came out called Waking Up. And this was a description of the experience that led him into years of practice and spiritual seeking. So he's with a friend here, and he writes, and I think he was 19 at the time. In the midst of this ordinariness, I was suddenly struck by the knowledge that I loved my friend. This shouldn't have surprised me. He was, after all, one of my best friends. However, at that age, I was not in the habit of dwelling on how much I loved the men in my life. Now I could feel that I loved him, and this feeling had ethical implications that suddenly seemed as profound as they now sound pedestrian on the page. I wanted him to be happy. That conviction came crashing down with such force that something seemed to give way inside of me. My capacity for envy, for instance, the sense of being diminished by the happiness or success of another person, seemed like a symptom of mental illness that vanished without a trace. What did I care if my friend was better looking or a better athlete than I was? If I could have bestowed those gifts on him, I would have. Truly wanting him to be happy made his happiness my own. And then came the insight that irrevocably transformed my sense of how good human life could be. I was feeling boundless love for one of my best friends, and I suddenly realized that if a stranger had walked through the door at that moment, he or she would have been fully included in this love. Love what was at bottom impersonal and deeper than any personal history could justify. The insight had the character of a geometric proof. It was as if, having glimpsed the properties of one set of parallel lines, I suddenly understood what must be common to them all. Find that very beautiful evocation of something in the metta, kindness, mudita, joy realm. And it is like it's like suddenly grasping a kind of geometric proof, which is to see how deeply we all long to be happy. And for that to take more and more territory in one's mind. The Buddha celebrates these qualities and this very pointed experience that Harris describes is of value, but it can be systematically cultivated. So the Buddha says in Guttara Nikaya, there is no way that when mudita has been developed, pursued, handed the reins, and taken as a basis, given a grounding, steadied, consolidated, and well undertaken, resentment would still keep overpowering the mind. Now, in reflecting on mudita, I was trying to think of what I could say about it, what I could say about joy, about developing, manufacturing joy, and it was not. I couldn't say much. about developing joy. Even though joy has been a real fruit of the practice, but I could say a lot about what obstructs joy. Joy is, mudita is tricky, it's tricky and often considered sort of one of the most difficult to cultivate of the kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. Joy is sort of most difficult to cultivate, as sometimes said. And you can see maybe how that might be so, because joy is just in its nature very spontaneous and a kind of forced, legislated joy that is a contradiction in terms, right? So I was thinking about like being photographed and the command to smile, you know. And my childhood is littered with photographs where I have this like pasted on smile that was supposed to be an expression of joy or something, but. And mudita is not is not that forced smile. Instead, we're looking to actually dismantle the obstacles, and this is at the heart of the Buddhist path. That the Buddhist path is much more about. The nature of its psychology is such that it's not so much about creating goodness, but dismantling the obscurations, the obstacles. And that's why the Buddhist psychology sometimes seems pessimistic in some way. But in an important sense, the obstacles are our only problem. And it was not as if the Buddha was enlightened and then, you know, if we think about the kind of mythic story, sitting under that tree was enlightened and then he was like, you know what would make this better? Ice cream. It's like, no, if we're not suffering, that's things get very simple, and the mind is naturally inclines towards mudita, joy in the face of well-being of another, naturally inclines towards kindness and compassion. So what obstructs mudita? The essayist Joseph Epstein said of the seven deadly sins, so lust, gluttony, greed, laziness, wrath, pride, envy. Of the seven deadly sins, only envy is no fun at all. Now, envy. Maybe just say a word about envy and jealousy. They get used interchangeably. But envy usually refers to a kind of, usually two people, and it's like an upward social comparison where I'm on the losing end, and so I want something someone else has. And jealousy is usually three, where in some ways we feel it's usually more interpersonal, and we feel threatened. You know, the classic arrangement is in the sphere of love and, you know, jealousy of the ex or whatever it may be. But it's a more of a kind of threatened by the quality of a relationship that two others have. And, you know, it's clear that there may be, it makes sense that our evolutionary history has conserved envy and jealousy across the generations. Right, it makes sense that evolutionary fitness in some ways could be enhanced by envy, jealousy, possessiveness. But it's also useful to remember that happiness is not at the top of evolution's to-do list. That, at best, is a kind of byproduct, right? And the Buddha kind of intuited this, that something in the mechanisms of the human body, brain, mind, don't work for well-being. So this is an evolutionary psychologist who is writing here about jealousy specifically, and in the realm of sexual partners. And so this is David Buss. Despite the manifold unhappiness jealousy creates, jealousy has a crystalline functional logic, precise purposes, and supreme sensibility. It exists today in modern humans because those in the evolutionary past who were indifferent to the sexual contact that their mates had with others lost the evolutionary contest to those who became jealous. As descendants of successful ancestors, modern humans carry with them passions that led to their forebears' success. The legacy of this success is a dangerous passion that creates unhappiness. But the unhappiness motivated adaptive action over human evolutionary history. Now this is why the Buddhist path in an important sense goes against the stream. That the Buddha discerns some of this, that some of our habits, some of the evolutionary pressures that we've inherited actually conduce towards unhappiness. And so in a way, he turned things on its head. The basic life project became one not about competition, getting, and owning, but became a path of letting go. It's a very radical gesture. Now, for me, and sometimes just knowing, just being clear on the depth of the conditioning that lives in me is actually helpful when I see my mind, you know, leaning towards competition, getting, owning. But I know that I can't be fully happy living under the directives of those forces. This is not possible. Now, it's curious that that envy often arises in relation to people who are fairly similar to us. And we can even see how the relentlessness of the comparing mind it helps from those comparisons we build self. And part of how we know who we are, or we think we know who we are, is through these kinds of comparisons. We build the self out of perception and proliferative thinking. And the comparing mind runs very deep and is a important part of this building process. Now, what I would say is that envy is very helpful insofar as it shows us where we're identified. Does that make sense? That it's the places of identification. I am, and then we can fill in the blank. But it's in these places that envy is fertile ground for envy. And we can also see how this kind of self-identification, I am, it impairs love and short circuits any joy we might have. So the example that I give is when I see break dancers, I do not feel threatened at all. It's just delight, you know, like, how are you doing that? Like, do I have extra ligaments and tendons that there's no sense of like, oh, you know, it's just so remote, so science fiction-y that there's no, and the truth is, I am not identified as a breakdancer. That is one of the things that I, one of the identities I have never picked up. Many others I have, right? And so in the face of that, the heart is very free. I just can delight. But I was remembering when I was a graduate student, and one of my fellow students got a very prestigious grant, and the kind of grant that you're really not, people don't get as grad students, but she got it. And I remember thinking, it would have been nicer if she didn't get that. Right? Now, why the difference? What was operating in my mind at that time? Clearly, there's some cherishing of the self-view of I am. I am a researcher, I am capable, I'm whatever. And to the extent that is, we cling to that and hold that, and that builds the self we are put on our heels and in a defensive position. And the success and delight and well-being of others, all of it is potentially threatening. So my first teacher, Zigar Khangchul Rinpoche, said that this kind of envy highlights the insanity of egoic life. That insofar as we live in this deeply identified way, I am, I am, I am, the world is full of potential enemies, to use kind of dramatic language. And the ego tolerates nothing good outside itself. Like, it wants all goodness for itself. So this is Matthieu Ricard. In every instance, envy is the product of a wound to self-importance and the fruit of an illusion. What can other people's happiness possibly deprive us of? Nothing, of course. Only the ego can be wounded by it and feel it as pain. These are the results of our having forgotten our innermost potential for affection and peace. So on this path in our practice, we are asking again and again, am I this? Am I that? And we have to see in our own way, no. No. That whatever we take to summarize ourselves to be, it is always, always at least a little wrong. And as this insight sinks into the bones, new delights are open to us. We're freed in an important way of a certain kind of territoriality. And we are less and less possessive of our own happiness, less and less threatened of the well-being of others. Couple more things. When we come to know the First Noble Truth deeply, a lot changes. So the First Noble Truth that is sometimes called the truth of suffering, but it's really unsatisfactoriness, or it's really giving up hope that some particular thing or experience will complete us, or that owning something can actually end the craving. That's the fantasy that we're trying to break. We're trying to break the fantasy that if only that will, what we're imagining is really the end of craving, not the delight of the thing we get. Does that make sense? And some of what we're giving up in working with the First Noble Truth is that fantasy. And when we give that up, and we can give it up in deeper and deeper ways, when we give that fantasy up, what people have, what others have, is so much less threatening. Because it's true, like money doesn't buy happiness, but it definitely buys pleasure, right? But we know what pleasure can and can't do. We know what the things of the world can and can't do. And we know that the deepest, most meaningful aspect of our happiness is the trajectory of our own heart. And so having a very personal, intimate relationship with Dharma is a kind of deep protection against envy. And in these ways, the heart becomes lighter. The well-being of others is hits us more and more deeply, becomes more and more poignant, more and more infectious, because it's like we're not braced against it at all. It just can fill the heart, mind. Rumi says, "Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground." It's just sit together for a moment. Whatever goodness is been created in our efforts together, may this be of service in the world. May whatever joy, freedom, peace that is ours, may this be of benefit for everything we encounter. So, thank you. Nice to spend the morning with you. Take good care.